Good afternoon. Is it on? Can you hear me? Oh, okay. Good afternoon. I hope everybody had a great lunch and a nice break. Applause for the lunch. Good job, Neil. Great menu. Okay. We have a treat in store for us this afternoon. Straight from Hofstra University and on his way to Florida for Monday night's debate is the co-chairman of the Commission on Presidential Debates. I think we're very lucky that he was able to squeeze us into his busy schedule. He's the former press secretary for President Bill Clinton. He serves as a communications consultant in Washington, D.C., where he's a partner with Public Strategies Washington, Inc. He also blogs for the Huffington Post and the Daily Beast. But even more important than all those things, all those accomplishments, he's a very active and committed United Methodist. I'm talking about Mike McCurry. He's a member of St. Paul's United Methodist Church in Kensington, Maryland. He's been a lay delegate to General Conference twice, once in 2004 and 2008, but not 2012, so none of that was his fault. He's a former member of the board of United Methodist Communications and currently serves on the board of Wesley Theological Seminary, where he's also a student working on his Master's of Divinity? Theology. Of Theology, Master's of Theology. So I think we have a lot of interesting things to hear from Mike McCurry.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Linda. That I appreciate that introduction because a lot of times, you know, having been press secretary of the president, sometimes, you know, you think pretty highly of yourself. And if you've been here in Washington, I know many of you from out of town, you probably have had to take a cab somewhere. And a lot of the cab drivers here in Washington are from foreign countries, but they are all political junkies, it seems like, because they listen to C-SPAN and watch C-SPAN all the time. And I always have this experience. I'll get in a cab and the cab driver will look up and say, "Hey, you're Mike McCurry. Whatever happened to you?" So I always get to tell the story. You know, my kids are even worse about it. They say, "Well, Dad, yeah, you may have been famous, but that was in the last century." So, but what I'd like to do is some personal reflections on what I'm going through right now, because what I'm going through is a part of being in parallel universes, both the church work that I do, both in my local congregation where I'm the lay leader, the work that I've done on behalf of our denomination in some things I want to talk about today, in addition to the things I've been doing at Wesley Seminary. But obviously, I'm still a political person, and I've been very active in watching campaigns. I've spent about 35 years working in various campaigns, and you will know those famous characters from history, President John Glenn, Vice President Lloyd Benson, President Mike Dukakis, and President Bob Kerry, President John Kerry. There's a great outfit called the National Democratic Institute. In fact, we just had them up in Hofstra for the debate earlier in the week, and they once sent me to Poland to consult with a guy named Mazowiecki, who ran against Lech Walesa for president of Poland. So, I don't know why, but you picked a world-class loser when it comes to presidential campaigns to talk today. But I do want to talk about my experiences in politics and the dysfunction that exists in the world of politics today, because right across that river, over there in the Congress building that you can almost see here from the Hyatt, things are very badly broken. We are a polarized, gridlocked, bitter, mean-spirited country when it comes to our leadership. And it reminds me that there are things that are similarly dysfunctional about the church, which is why I quickly pointed out I was not a delegate to the 2012 General Conference, because we know so much about the things that are not going well in our denomination and in the church universal. And I think there are some things that are similar in these two worlds that I experience day in and day out, and that's what I'd like to talk about a little bit today. I'll start with two experiences that I've had recently. One is obviously being at the debate and watching our two major candidates for president slug it out, which they almost literally did the other night. I happen to be there, you know, one of the great things about being on the commission is there are a lot of young people who volunteer from the colleges that host these events. And after the debate, there were a bunch of them kind of gathered around in the hall and helping direct people. So after the debate, some of them that I'd gotten to know happened to be standing around in the lobby. And I got them all together to just mostly thank them for the hard work that they'd done. But we got talking about the debate, and I asked them, I said, well, what do you think? And one young guy said, well, it was an interesting debate, but they really didn't answer any of the questions that were posed. And so that triggered a whole conversation about, well, what are your peer group think about the campaign that we've had? And most of them said it's so negative. They don't like the attacks. They don't like the fact that no one seems to be talking realistically about what's going to happen. And they're all very realistic. They all responded, if you watched the debate the other night, very much to that very first question from the young guy who was graduating from college and said, you know, what am I supposed to do? Where are the jobs going to be for me? And there was a sense, really, of some dispiritedness in that collection of people. They felt like they were not getting from these two national leaders competing for the presidency the kinds of things that they would expect to see as leadership in a very great country like ours. And I thought about that because then I had an experience the week before talking with a group of people in a panel about a recent survey that was done. I think probably some of you saw the coverage of it. It was done by the Pew Research Center's Forum on Religion and Public Life. This was a study of what they called the religiously unaffiliated, but they are sort of nicknamed the nuns, as in none of the above, not N-U-N. But and it was, those results of that poll were striking to me because of something it said about young people today. I just want to cite some of the statistics. By the way, it's online. You can get it at the Pew website, and it's a great study done by a guy named Greg Smith. But a couple of the findings in that survey, this asked people, you know, what is your religious affiliation? What, you know, what are your attitudes about worship and other things? One of the critical findings, for the first time ever, less than 50% of all Americans describe themselves as Protestant. It's a 48% number. Now, that number as recently as the 1970s was probably 67%. Go back to 1960, it was 75%. This is a historic breakpoint that less than half of this country now self-identifies as being a Protestant. But a couple of other things about it. That means about 46 million people that we're talking about that really claim no affiliation to any religious institution. They're not all atheists. Only about 13 million said that they, you know, professed to not believe in God. But they're not church people. The remaining 33 million, many of them describing themselves as religious people, but just didn't feel like they had a home in any particular denomination. Two-thirds said they believed in God. 76% said that prayer was an important part of their daily life. 58% said that religion wasn't important to them. It's something that mattered to them. But it was clear that they're not connected in any way to any place that gives them a spiritual home. But what struck me was what young people said. The group that was self-described as being none of the above or religiously unaffiliated was disproportionately young, 30% of them under age 30, compared to about only 9% over age 65 that said that they were not affiliated with any particular church. And they, you know, for me as a practicing political guy, the other thing interesting is that they were disproportionately Democratic. They tended to support Democratic candidates. They said that if they leaned one way or another towards a party, it was towards the Democratic Party. And that kind of gives rise to something that is frequently commented upon during the political season, that there's a God gap in this country, kind of a red God and a blue God. And if you are more likely to be a regular spiritual worshiper attending church at least once a week, the likelihood is that you are not only probably Republican, but you're probably a conservative Republican, as opposed to those who, you know, don't worship and are more likely to be Democratic or liberal. I started thinking about that and said, you know, that's a calamity, because it means that there are a whole bunch of things that are happening in which people are not getting something that they're looking for, either from the political system or from the religious life that they would experience if they were in regular worship and in a community of faith. And I think that probably is something of a crisis for us, because if there is no connection that you're feeling to people that you're in community with, that you worship with regularly, there is no way in which you can then sit down and begin to experience other things that bring you together with people who come from different walks of life. And I personally think this is really, really critical. Because if you think about it, given how polarized this country is, given how likely it is that, you know, you could wake up in the morning and read the Washington Times, which is our local conservative newspaper, and turn on Fox News and then listen to Rush Limbaugh later in the day, and you've got kind of one set of experiences about what's happening in the life of our country. Or you could get up and read the Washington Post, our liberal newspaper, and turn on CNN and listen to NPR, and then you have a whole different experience about what's happening in this country. And we separate ourselves into these two divided camps without having a common place in which we can talk rationally about the differences that we have as American citizens. The church and the pews in our church are the only places that Republicans and Democrats are going to regularly gather on a weekly basis and come together and do something together that is important to them. And yet, how many of our pastors stand up in a pulpit on Sunday and force the issue of how are we going to talk about these issues that divide us, that are so important? In this political season, how many pastors will dare to stand up and say, there are really important issues our country faces, let's talk about what we're hearing the candidates say, and how are they living out and witnessing to the things that they self-profess to believe? That's a daunting question, because my sense is that if the subject of politics comes up, most ministers run the other direction, because they don't want to provoke controversy within their own congregation. They know they're going to get someone mad at them if they start talking about politics and issues of the day. And so for me, that's, you know, personally, one of the things that kind of animates what I want to be working on now in my statesman-like role now that I've left the White House. And it is the thing that sort of personally for me occasions some reflection on how does my own faith call me to witness in this political world that I've lived in for most of my career. I'll tell you, it's a very secular place, particularly on the Democratic side. You don't see many political operatives thinking about what they're going to do on Sunday morning, because they've already committed themselves to meet the press, face the nation, the Sunday New York Times, and really kind of absorbing what's happening in the political world, not how they might actually be fed spiritually to think about how we repair some of the brokenness that exists in this country. And if I could do anything in my semi-retirement now, it would be to figure out how we bring people together, how we actually learn to have civil dialogue around the issues that matter, and how we provoke the kinds of conversations in our churches and in our fellowship halls that would really get people to think about those things that matter most to the future of our country. I mean, to me, that's what politics is about, and I think that's what we are called to do as people who witness to the gospel. My own life story. I, you know, because I think about these kids who are nuns now and not affiliating with our churches, and I think about back a long time ago now, given all my gray hair, when I was in church youth group. I grew up in Northern California in the San Francisco Bay Area, in a very tumultuous time in the late 1960s, where our church youth group used to board on buses and go and participate in anti-war protests in San Francisco. Those of you who know the history of that place, we went to the People's Park demonstrations in Berkeley in 1967. And for me, the church became an entryway into the world of politics that I've discovered that I loved. Now, the problem was that as I got more and more interested in politics and change and being an active campaign participant, what got left behind was that sense of spiritual grounding that you would get from a place in which you were thinking through what does Scripture call us to do in a community in which we are trying to live out our political beliefs. I was very motivated by the social gospel that we know so well and thinking how to take care of the least, the last, and the lost, but what was not happening for me was any sense that I was getting my own spiritual renewal in a place of worship that would motivate me. Now, by the way, at that point in our lives where we lived, I was in a congregational church, not a Methodist church, so let the record show. In fact, I first went to a big church gathering as a delegate to the General Synod of the United Church of Christ. So they do things a lot differently than we do at our General Conference. But reflecting on that and what happened when the church became so secular and what happened when the church began to plunge into a lot of the social changes and the political contests that were very much a part of the 60s and 70s, I think teaches us a little bit about what's happened to the decline in the mainstream church generally. Because I think if you don't unite this both that we need, a sense of the gospel of salvation that is really speaking to our heart, and then motivating us to be out in the community to live that gospel out in what we do to bring justice and equality and progress to our communities, you're missing something. And I think that's the missing something that we confront now. There's at Wesley Seminary, and probably some graduates of Wesley Seminary may be even here, if you've ever walked around the campus, the library building has got a cornerstone that's got that great phrase from Charles Wesley, to unite the pair so often disjoined, vital piety and knowledge. And for me, my quest now in life is to how do I take my own personal faith, which is being so richly renewed by my experiences as a student and by the work that I've been doing for our denomination and in my local congregation, and then apply that to what I try to do day in and day out in my regular work, in my day job. And it's hard because it is not a vocabulary that freely mixes back and forth. So I thought about that today. I thought about coming and talking to all of you because we're all communicators in one sense or another for our church and for our denomination. And I said, what difference could we as a community of communicators make to our denomination as we confront this reality that there's something broken in our church and something badly broken in our country, and how can we be a part of the effort to repair that breach? And so I came up with my prescriptions, and then I had actually intended to come and have a press conference and let you ask any question that you want. I mean, you can ask me about Monica or Hillary or any of the other women in my life if you want to. But I thought I would start with just some general observations about what I think we need to do as communicators, and then I really want to mix it up and get into your questions. But the first, thinking about these young people and what they're searching for, and then realizing something else very important, because as you look at the demographics of the electorate that will go to the polls November 6th, you're struck by the fact that we are now, I think 2008 was the first election in which, first most recent election in which a majority of the electorate was under age 50, but that's clearly going to be a trend. There's a generational change happening in our country that's vital to the campaigns that are being run right now by Obama and Romney. They are trying everything they can to figure out how do we motivate that younger people who have been sort of turned off by politics to be re-engaged. In 2008, Obama was pretty successful in motivating and energizing young people, but the number in recent polls that say that they're going to participate and intend to vote in this election is down 25% from those who said they were going to participate last time. So they're searching for this, but one of the reasons for that is because this baby boom generation that I am a part of is exiting stage right. And frankly, we haven't done a very good job of addressing the issues the country faces. If you think about the debates we're having and that we're going to have increasingly right after the election as we go into a lame duck session of Congress and then into next year, they are about the future of Medicare and our Social Security system, our entitlement systems. They're about, are we going to have a comprehensive energy policy that really does something about our dependence on foreign sources of oil? Are we going to improve our education system for those who are going to go out and compete in the global economy? What are we going to do about our health care system? Are we going to implement the health care reforms that have been approved, or are we going to change them? And then, you know, what is America's role in the world at a time when we still have wars underway and we confront terror and we're trying to figure out how we can project our mammoth strength as a military superpower in a way that's consistent with the values that we have? And I thought back to 1976 when I first arrived here in Washington and started working on Capitol Hill. Jimmy Carter was president, remember that? And he wore his little cardigan sweater and told us to turn down the thermostat because we didn't have a comprehensive national energy policy. We didn't have schools that were working, so he created the Department of Education. We had a big debate about budget deficits and entitlements and Social Security. And we were debating, obviously, what to do about our place in the world. The more I thought about it, I said, it's Groundhog Day. We're having the same debate now over and over. So the generation that has been in leadership that's utterly failed to kind of bring us together to solve those problems now is departing. And it is not unlike, if you've read the work of Lovett Weems about the church, what he calls the death tsunami, because those same baby boomers are starting to die off and leave the church and leave us in a place in which we are increasingly empty. And unless we can do something to reach that younger person that is disproportionately unaffiliated with church and increasingly despondent about the quality of our politics, we're going to have a really screwed up country that doesn't have a place where they find a spiritual home that helps nurture a sense of belonging and togetherness that deals with that brokenness and despair. So these are my prescriptions. And the first one is the obvious one. And to, you know, echo my friend James Carville, it's about the young people, stupid. We've got to concentrate on how we reach them. And we have got to figure out in our communications how our vocabulary and how our witness that we express through what we do increasingly shifts in the direction of social media and places where, looking around at some of you who are on laptops and tweeting and doing all of that, how do we reach those people in the ways in which they get their content and their information now? It's not through the church bulletin. It's not through the conference newsletter. It's through new ways in which we get out and communicate aggressively with people who, you know, are looking for someone to deliver the message. The second thing I would say is that we've got to, I call this reverse tithe. And what I would propose is that, and we look at our budgets for communications programs across the connection, that only 10% should be devoted to the work of the church and the process and discipline and the things that we do organizationally to run our church, and 90% ought to be directed towards evangelical efforts that communicate outwards bound to these people who are, you know, are spiritual but don't think the church is giving them any place to express that spirituality. So a rethinking of how we use our resources more effectively to communicate more effectively with the people who aren't hearing what we have to say. The third thing would be, we have got to do a better job of educating our Episcopal leadership about the importance of communications. You know? These bishops think communication is giving sermons, powerful preaching. And they have very little understanding, I think, of what it takes in this complex multimedia world of the new media and social media and all the things that are changing the technology of communications. I don't think they have a clue, most of them, about what it takes to penetrate and break through and get the message across. The fourth thing is that we need some priority in what we're trying to say. Now, our priority is obviously the gospel good news that we have to deliver. But, you know, we try to say too many things as a church. You pick up our book of resolutions and go through that. And good Lord, there is not a subject on the face of the planet that Methodists don't have a position on. And that's when you try to say everything, you effectively say nothing, because you're not concentrating on something that is powerful. Now, I'm going to take a little moment here to do some propaganda for one of the things that I work on as a member of our church. I'm on the, with some in the room like Larry and others, I'm on the executive committee of the Global Health Initiative of the denomination. Now, just to remind you, but, you know, I say this a little bit sarcastically, we have four areas of focus in our denomination. Our General Conference approved them 8 years ago and reaffirmed them 4 years ago. But there is probably 99% of the Methodists in all of our pews that have no clear idea that we have those four stated priorities that are supposed to be the focus of what we are trying to do. And I won't embarrass you by naming them, all four of them, but I'll tell you that one of them is that we are addressing the diseases of poverty. We're doing that, to begin with, by a concentrated effort to do something truly historic and extraordinary, which is to eradicate deaths by malaria. And we're making progress in that. You know, several years ago, one kid every minute was dying from a disease that was totally preventable, that we could do something about, and now it's, you know, I'm sorry, one kid every 30 seconds was dying, and now it's one kid every 60 seconds, and we're moving the trend in the right direction. But, you know, we've committed as a denomination to advance the idea that we could be a part of this historic effort to end deaths by malaria. And that we're going to raise $75 million as a church to support our work that we do. We do incredibly good work through UMCOR and through the Board of Global Ministries in Africa and other places. And we aren't telling that story. I harangue Larry Holland once a week on why is, you know, the digest of the United News Service not regularly featuring something on Imagine No Malaria. You know, if you are in a church that hasn't had the experience of being a part of the campaign, I would venture to say nobody in that church knows that we have made this commitment on a church to fight malaria and to be a part of this historic effort. And if it truly is an area of focus, that means we ought to be talking about this all the time, because I don't need to tell a room of communicators that it's repetition that matters. But why isn't every time we put out a newsletter, every time we send out a communication, every time we print a magazine, why isn't there an update on how we're doing on this campaign? Why don't we have 100% of the people in our church knowing that I'm a Methodist and I'm eradicating malaria? Because I venture to say, if people knew we were doing something like that, that would say, that's the church that I want to be a part of. Because they're out there in the world making a difference. But we get drift off. We have so many other priorities. We have so many other things that we're doing. Well, we've got this initiative here. Or we're doing that there. And we don't come back to focus on what we claim to be an area of focus. So that's an admonition right there. I think if you know anything about our efforts on malaria, young people have been on fire with nothing but nets. And what we're doing now is taking nothing but nets to the next level and doing something to build on what we know is the enthusiasm that's out there to do something that will truly make a difference in rebuilding the public health infrastructure in many countries in Africa. I think we're up now to, Larry, 29 countries that we are actively working in one way or another, and we've got, you know, we can tell our folks that we're using that money wisely, and we've got mechanisms in place to make sure that the bed nets and the help that we're giving gets to where it's supposed to go. It doesn't drift off and, you know, get misused. But, you know, unless we communicate like we mean it, people are not going to hear the message. So if it's not Imagine No Malaria, it's got to be something that is a big idea. I'll tell you one quick story. I'm taking up all my time for your questions. But just to explain how hard this is, I've told the story, probably some of you have heard it before, but to go back to my political experience, in 1996, when I was working for President Clinton and he was running for re-election, we went through the entire campaign practically with him not having kind of a central vision to describe what he was going to try to do in a second term. Gee, that might be a problem. What? Anyhow, set aside the current campaign. But it was frustrating to him because we would go through this. He'd give these great speeches, and Lord knows he can give a great speech. And he'd talk about all the good things are going up and all the bad things are going down, and he'd tick off all the statistics, and he'd talk for 45 minutes. People would cheer and clap, but then we'd go back, you know, to the hotel at the end of the day, and some of us would say, what is the defining choice between you and Bob Dole? What's the thing that motivates you to think, you know, as we look ahead for the next 4 years, you're going to make a difference doing something important for our country? And it was really not until Senator Dole gave his acceptance speech at the Republican convention where he talked about, you know, as a World War II hero, that he wanted to be a bridge to that great generation of the past that had done so many extraordinary things to save the world. And I remember we were watching it with President Clinton, and he slapped the table and said, "That's wrong. That's wrong. You got to be building bridges to the future because it's about the future, not the past." And he said, "But we've got to build a bridge to the 21st century. That's what we've got to do." And suddenly, the little light bulb went off, and he said, "That's it." And so, you know, for the rest of it, it became, you know, you finally got a message that works when you get sick and tired of it. And we went, all of our advance guys and all the remaining events of the campaign, they would actually build a little bridge, and Bill Clinton would walk over the bridge and come out and greet the audience and then talk about how we were going to build a bridge to the 21st century. That was his kind of the architecture of a message and the big idea that would then let him talk about all the other things that he wanted to talk about. Well, what's our big idea, Methodists? You know, if it's not eradicating malaria and deaths by malaria, what is it that really puts people on fire and gets them to say, "I want to be a part of that church"? So think about that. That's one other challenge. But look, the last and the most important thing, and then I will stop my sermonizing here, is the enormous changes that are happening now in the media and the way in which people gather and get content and use it and communicate with each other presents to us new and difficult challenges in the work that we have to do on behalf of our church. And Larry Holland's going to sign his book later, and so you'll have to go up and buy a copy. We get to buy a copy, right? You're not giving them away, I hope. Oh, you crazy man. See, that, by the way, I have a whole other lecture about how we shouldn't give away content if it's got value. We ought to make people to pay for it because then they think they're getting something of real value. So next time. Well, thank you for donating the book. But his book, We Must Speak, I think goes through the whole litany of things that we have to think about and the reasons why we as a church have kind of fallen behind the curve when it comes to how we communicate, not keeping up with the enormous changes that are out there. But that would be my last and final plea, is that we have got to figure out how to get out on the cutting edge of these new technologies of communication and orient ourselves to using the resources that we do have to create best practices in how churches communicate. Because I personally think, and having served on UMCOM, I think we have some of the most talented people that are in media relations and marketing and advertising who work on behalf of an organized denomination. I mean, I know the talent that we've got and that's out there. I know the struggle to get the budget dollars necessary to actually use that talent effectively, and I commiserate. But I think if we sort of really led the way in saying we are going to make it a priority for us to be an organization that figures out how to join this disjointed sense of the vital piety that we need as people of faith and how we live out that faith in the world in which we go to witness and serve, I think we can make an enormous difference in this world for our church and for the millions and millions of Methodists out there that are looking for us to make a big difference. That's the message I wanted to come deliver today. Thank you for letting me come. Now, I don't know what your schedule is, but as promised, any subject you want, if you want to ask me why the moderators have been so good, so bad, so indifferent, I've been dealing with the crisis du jour today is, you know, why did Candy Crowley interrupt and correct Mitt Romney, and should she be fact-checking or not fact-checking? And, you know, I can give you my answer to that if you want to hear it. But Greg, you got a question?
Mike, I'm just curious how you feel that after the process of what I'm pretty sure is some intense negotiations with staff about who gets this many minutes, where they can stand, how close they can come to each other, what the moderator will do, to then have the candidates get up there and just blow the rules away.
Well, actually, this is important. The truth is the Commission on Presidential Debates, which is really a creature of, I'll give you a little of the history of it because it is kind of interesting. Remember talking about the changes that technology make in our lives. The first televised debate was just over 50 years ago in 1960 between Kennedy and Nixon. We all kind of know a bit about that history. It was not then until 1976 that there was another presidential debate. And the reason was both Lyndon Johnson, for his reasons, and Richard Nixon, for his reasons, decided they didn't want to have to debate some pesky challenger who came along. Why should I have to get on stage with someone who's trying to take my job away from me? So there was no given that there would be regular debates between the presidential candidates. The League of Women Voters then got involved and tried to structure it, but they, you know, frankly, they got so absorbed in exactly those kinds of details, including letting the campaigns choose the moderator, at least, you know, from a list of known journalists cross off the ones that they did not want to have moderate. They had an experience in 1980 where they went through 76 different proposed journalists and couldn't agree on someone. So because of that and because of some academic studies that were done both at Harvard and Georgetown, the suggestion was made that there ought to be some kind of independent entity that would just institutionalize these debates and make them happen. And the two political party chairs at the time, Frank Fahrenkopf for the Republicans and Paul Kirk for the Democrats, who was later my boss, in fact, took that on and said, okay, we will set aside our partisanship and create an independent, nonpartisan body, a nonprofit organization that will sponsor these debates. And so that's how the commission got going 25 years ago. And 1988 was the first campaign in which they actually had a role in sponsoring the debates. But we have always taken the position that all that matters is that the voters need to see the candidates debate face to face. They need to have some kind of format that is balanced, that gives people, you know, ample opportunity to express their views, and that the moderators should be journalists so that the event itself is a news event, because otherwise we'd be subject to equal time requirements in federal law and other aspects of federal election law, and we'd have to invite all 143 candidates for president to participate. That's how many there are. There are only five, by the way, that theoretically or mathematically could win the Electoral College, but there are five, and there's a whole... And then, so we had to establish some criteria. Well, who do you invite? And our general criteria is you have to have kind of in a range of national polls, 15%. But we only say, here's the venue, here's the date, here's the moderator, and here's the format. And this time around, we have changed the format to try to limit the amount of exactly the kind of rules you just described. Well, you get 90 seconds to speak, and you get 30 seconds to respond, and you get 30 seconds to rebut. We've stripped a lot of that out and just created chunks of time in which each candidate is supposed to get 2 minutes to answer an initial question and then go into a more free-flowing discussion. And we've had that. I mean, I'd be interested in your reaction. I think these have been much more lively, engaging debates than what in the past amounted to sort of dueling press conferences with the candidates just kind of spouting their talking points. But we didn't, you know, as to all the rules, the campaigns get together sometimes and negotiate a memorandum, which Romney and Obama did, and it's like a 30-page document that governs all kinds of stuff. And we said, that's fine, that's your agreement, but we're not bound by that, and neither is the moderator bound by it. So I think Candy did a pretty good job of trying to move things along. She let Romney go on and on and on towards the end because, frankly, he was coming up short on time. Obama had spoken, had more minutes with the microphone than Romney did, so she let him go a little bit. Although it's interesting, Obama had, I think, 44 minutes of airtime, and Romney had 41 minutes of airtime. But in looking at the transcript, Romney spoke 470 more words than Obama did in that period of time, which is kind of interesting. So, not unique words. And some of them mystifying words, binders of women. What is that? I can't be partisan, but that's one of... It's actually been one of the great things about this job for me is it's given me the excuse that I don't have to go and be a pundit and flap my yams that much on television. But the campaigns do have their own understanding of the rules. And then the candidates, you know, do what they feel like they need to do once they get on stage. And the important point is to kind of try to keep it moving along and try to cover as many subjects as you can and not let them filibuster and not let them, you know, hog the microphone. Yeah. Hold on for just a second, because I think they want to try to get this on the microphone.
Seems like recent presidents have occasionally visited a church, usually at St. John's, very close to the White House. From your perspective, having worked in the White House, what are the logistical difficulties for a president in visiting a church, and would that explain why no recent president has really been an active part of a congregation?
Yeah, it is an enormous logistical burden on a church to have a president walk in, even on a otherwise quiet Sunday morning, because the Secret Service comes and things have to be blocked off. I think now post 9/11, all the members of the congregation have to pass through a magnetometer and be screened. So it is disruptive. But on the other hand, there's also something at work there, which I experienced with John Kerry in 2004. I was on his campaign at the end. And many political leaders are not comfortable with outward expressions of faith. If you think about those that have been more comfortable sort of with the demonstration of their faith commitment, they have been members of more professing-oriented denominations. Like you think Clinton, think Carter, the Baptists, they witness. And they tell the story, but John Kerry, a Catholic, I think Barack Obama is a liberal Protestant, have a harder time actually expressing their own faith. Governor Romney, for other reasons, which I think it's he's beginning to talk a little bit more about his own faith commitment and his own. He hasn't talked about the theology of the Mormon Church, but it's an interesting theology. A friend of mine at Wesley said, you know, if you look at Mormonism and unpack their theology, it's Methodism on LSD. Don't say that I said that, but he was saying it not in a pejorative way. He said it's a very interesting, you know, the eschatology, the sense of, you know, the modern day saint it's a pretty interesting stuff. In fact, we've done at Wesley. We had a great program. Back earlier in the year, it was really a conversation between the Wesley tradition and the Mormon tradition, and what is unique and different and about them, and it was pretty interesting. But I think it is a combination. I know in President Obama's case, he's got a guy on his staff that does a lot of faith outreach to the faith community, and he said, "Look, the president would do it, and the president worships regularly at Camp David." But he just he's uncomfortable with both the disruption to the congregation when he goes, and to the sense that he is somehow or other trying to exhibit his own faith in a way that would look like it was a political endeavor. And I think that now in the midst of a campaign, if he suddenly started, you know, walking around holding his Bible, going to church on Sunday, people would suspect that it had something to do with the campaign. But I personally would like to see our president out there and demonstrating that his faith matters to him. But more importantly, I would prefer that what he believes and what he feels and what Scripture calls him to do is reflected in what he does every single day in the Oval Office. And I wish we would be talking about more of the people that we hear Jesus talk about in his ministry in the course of these campaigns. Not one question nor answer about people who are poor and homeless in this country so far. Now, Romney has made the point that the poverty is going up in this country, which is true, and because of the recession, but he hasn't said a whole lot about what he would propose to do about it as president. So I, you know, there are ways in which, a lot of ways in which I think if we had a deeper understanding of how faith calls us and got over the sense that the separation of church and state means that we separate faith and political belief, because I think those are two really different things. And I think our country is a country that's got religion in its DNA, and we have from the very beginning, from the founders. So I think it should be a natural thing for any elected leader to talk about what their own personal faith tradition calls them to do in their position of political leadership. And by the way, that's something I'm working on now at Wesley. We are on the verge of creating a new center for the missional church that will have a program in public theology at its core that Professor Sean Casey has been working on. I think that what we say, we're in Washington, we ought to be an institution that's leading the way in getting people to say that it is okay for people to express how their religion calls them to do things one way or another in the public realm. Yes, way in the back there.
Thank you. Something you said at the beginning of your remarks with us this afternoon about perspectives that are present or becoming more absent in the life of the church. You talked about perhaps some of the more conservative voices being more professing in their faith. So the question about where is the prophetic voice in the church, the progressive voice in the church, if that continues the trend that you cited of being more and more absent, where does then that prophetic voice emerge and how can that be encouraged?
Well, it's good. If you go back and you think of our recent history, I mean, I'm talking about my own experiences of a child growing up in the 1960s, think of how prophetic the voice of Martin Luther King was during the Civil Rights Movement. I mean, the letter from Birmingham Jail is a letter to clergy people and calling on them to make a difference in what they're doing and changing the ways in which they have lived out their lives in the Deep South. But I think along the way, it was something about the secular pull of politics and the enormous changes that we went through in the 60s and 70s that drew the liberal progressive voice out from the church and put it directly into the political mainstream, and the counter reaction to all of the enormous social changes and social upheaval occurring, which gave rise to the moral majority in the 1970s. Falwell started, I think, the moral majority in 1972 or 74, maybe. And so suddenly you had this sense that the religious voice was a conservative voice, lending itself to this newly rising conservative movement. And the counter-reaction to that was a liberal progressive voice that was becoming increasingly secular in its perspective. And so there was a division there. And frankly, people didn't call themselves back in to say, well, now, wait a minute. There's something beyond the gospel of salvation that we are called to as Christians to witness to, and it's being a part of a community that we build and that we strengthen and we take care of each other. And we kind of lost that spiritual grounding. We haven't had a reemergence of that voice. I think Obama has spoken powerfully to that theme on occasion, but not regularly. And there are a bunch of people. We have a lot of folks who are, you know, religious and working on the progressive side to say, you know, there is not a God gap that, I mean, we can close that God gap if we witness more effectively to what we believe and what we're called to do. So I think there are people who are trying to, you know, bring back that progressive faith voice into the public debate, but it's hard to hear. And it's not, you know, frankly, full disclosure, it's not being done very effectively by President Obama's campaign in Chicago right now. They had a higher priority on that in 2008 than they do in the re-election in 2012. And the reason for that is that a lot of the political operatives on the Democratic side are very secular people and don't share their own experiences. I mean, when I worked for President Clinton in the White House, you know, I went to church regularly. I had took Sabbath time on Sunday. I got away with not watching or going on the Sunday programs the entire time that I worked in the White House, which is now unusual for someone who's press secretary to the president. But I never shared that with anyone. I never said, you know, look, this is something important to me, and let me talk about it. And I found out only much later that the famous foul-mouthed Rahm Emanuel, who was, you know, my colleague in the Clinton White House, had his rabbi came every Saturday, and they read Torah together and prayed together. George Stephanopoulos, the son of an Orthodox minister, was deeply religious himself, and I sat next to the guy in every motorcade and on Air Force One for two whole years and never made that connection with him, and didn't until after I read his book, which is very revealing about how spiritually challenged he felt working in the White House and working in Washington politics. So I think part of this is just getting beyond the point where we feel uncomfortable with our own personal witness and getting out there and telling the story more often. Yes. I'm being given the hook up here, so make it a good question.
I want to go back to a couple of points you made a few minutes ago when you talked about the need to try to help our bishops to better understand making public statements and talking about issues. And also your observation that many of our pastors may be more concerned about keeping controversial issues out of the church discussion and discourse than they are about bringing it in. If we were to come to you and say, we're the communicators and it's our task to help these people overcome this, what would be some of the things you would encourage us to do to try to achieve that outcome?
Well, those are two separate questions. I mean, on the second one, how do you help a pastor feel more comfortable guiding a conversation on controversial issues in the congregation? We've got some great resources. I mean, many of you know Adam Hamilton at the Church of the Resurrection. He's made a cottage industry out of this. And he's got two series that are particularly good that I've taught both of them in adult ed in my church. One is Seeing Gray in a World of Black and White, which is a good, I think, an 8-part series, and very well structured with a lot of resources and DVDs, and you get to see Adam doing his preaching and everything. But it's good. It's really good stuff. And then he's got another one, which is, someone help me, it's Confronting the Controversies, I think, which is similar, but it's a guidebook. There's a pastor's guide that goes with the resource that actually, gives the pastor some scriptural context, gives them ideas on how to raise the issues and get people talking about it. And so I think we've got some resources out there. We certainly have to encourage their use. But at the level of, you know, the episcopacy, I think it is, how do I delicately say this? It's getting in the face of the Council of Bishops and getting on their agenda. They use up their time when they meet with all manner of nonsense. And they need to start getting down to what counts the most and not drift off and get into, you know, I mean, that from their worry about all the things they have to worry about come things like the call to action, which was so well-intentioned and appreciated by lay people in the church that said, yeah, we do need to do something about redundancies and overlaps and budget inefficiencies in the church, but to do that in the in to do it in the processes that they have ends up leading to kind of dysfunction that I think really hurts the church, because we are still hurting from that whole experience, my sense is. I mean, maybe I'm overreading that, but I, you know, maybe it's guys like me from the outside who've got some experience sitting down with them and saying, look, you all have got to understand that this world we live in puts a challenge on you that is so different than what you probably anticipated you were getting into when you first were called to seek the office that you're in. And I've had those exact conversations with some of our bishops, and they say, well, they usually then turn right around and say, well, can you help me? Can you get me media training? Can you, you know, who do I go to? And it's us, and it's the people in this room that they need to turn to. But I think we have got to be a little bolder in going and insisting that they think about how we're using our resources and our dollars as we try to reach the audiences we need to reach. So, you know, if I'm giving you a little prod there, that's exactly what I had hoped to do today. You know, that's a good place to stop. But thank you all for letting me come and share that.